How you doing, John?
Good. How are you guys?
Pretty good. Like I was saying just before we started recording, a little bit slow because I was at a Bruce Springsteen concert last night. But
so jealous.
It's cool because we're just having a light episode this week. Nothing terribly technical going on.
No. I mean, computers scare me. So I'm surprised that I became a developer at all, to be quite honest.
Well, yeah, me too. Because you're a big dummy. how did you get into computers? What was your earliest, impetus? What hooked you?
Don't remember the first time I used a computer because my dad was a math teacher. And this was back in the 70s, so I'm dating myself. And he took me in, and the setup was at the time that they had a punch card machine. So you could type in your program, mail it off to like the branch office or whatever it was, run the program and get the output back. So he took me in and actually helped me, quote unquote, punch out a little simple for loop or something like that, mailed it off and brought it back. And I was like, oh, this is really cool. The first memory I have of using a computer was a Commodore PET. Again, at school, and go in and you play Dam Buster or something like that. And I thought, oh, this is so cool. It's bright and shiny. Isn't this wonderful? So, I think somewhat atypically for kids from the 70s, I don't remember a time in my life where I wasn't aware of computers. So that was exciting. The first one we had at home though was, I think a lot of people, Commodore 64.
I
must have been 6 or 7. It was neat. I remember my mom commented something effective, it was better than Christmas for me. The day that we brought the Commodore 64 home, we had, BC's Quest for Tires, which was this little sort of side scrolling.
Jump
over the rocks, duck under the branches, that sort of thing. And,
based on the comic, the newspaper comic strip.
It was horribly repetitive, but I just thought it was the best thing ever. Doing that and, we were out in the middle of nowhere. The sticks and such. So, a lot of the BBSs and such that people used back then, we just didn't use. So it was sort of, whatever people could get on floppy disks. I remember my dad would come home with floppy disks full of programs and games and whatnot. And, every couple of weeks or something, it'd be like, oh, here's 20 programs on a floppy disk. And I'd go through them all obsessively. I didn't do a lot of programming then, though. You'd get Compute Magazine or something like that. And they'd have the hex listings in the back where you type out, 5,000 characters of machine code you have to type perfectly. So that kind of killed my interest in that fairly quickly. I thought it was all the programming just came across as magic, where it was
right.
The one time you get a basic listing, anybody who was doing anything cool would be peeking and poking. And I had no idea what any of this meant, being again, 6, 7, 8 years old. I thought it was all magic numbers and thought, I just kind of lost interest in it.
And the Commodore 64 lent itself well to that peek and poke kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think now the idea of you're running, there's a flat address space, there's no virtual memory. You're just simply going in and literally twiddling the frame buffer because it's sitting in the same place as everything else just seems insane. I look back on that and I'm like, wow, I should have really taken advantage of that when that was, the dominant platform. But It was just too complicated for me at the time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But the Commodore had some advantages over the Apple II, even in that getting graphics to the screen was a little bit easier. Because the Apple II had that funky stuff that WAS did that was there was the 80 column mode, then there was all the weird stuff. There was 2 planes, I believe, for the pixels and stuff. But the Commodore just had a pretty flat, easily accessible sort of sprite engine.
Yeah, I mean, looking back on it now, it looked like it was a fairly simple, straightforward design. But I mean, at the time, it seemed like dark voodoo. It's like, oh, peak, this address and this value, and it was like, what does this even mean? So,
yeah, coming by any kind of documentation
I think we had the manual that came with the Commodore 64, and. Mm-hmm. That was basically, that was at a time where the manual would include the full schematics for the PCB inside the computer.
Right.
Yeah. And, on one hand, that's amazing. That it was sort of one of these computers where you could actually fit the whole concept of the machine in your head at once. Yeah. On the flip side of it is that it assumed you had a certain knowledge of, ICs and circuit boards and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, when you're just starting out and you're cutting your teeth, it's, you know, sort of, you know, you've been thrown in the deep end with like weights around your legs.
Yeah. As a child.
Good luck.
Yeah.
You're going to, you're not going to succeed.
Right. So where'd you go from there? So,
so I played a lot of games on the Commodore 64, which was a lot of fun. And then we got a Atari ST in late 80s. And that came with, we got a copy somehow of GFA Basic, one of the limited versions of that. And that was actually the point where it's like, you know, it wasn't like Basic on the Commodore 64 with line numbers and all this stuff. So, you know, you ran out of line numbers. It's like, oh, crap, I have to go back and add stuff. And now I have to renumber everything. This is no fun. I quit. It was actually, you know, it felt like more like a reasonable programming language. And so, you know, I just started screwing around with that and started programming. And I thought, hey, I actually kind of like this programming stuff. This is kind of neat. And, you know, sort of very quickly came on to the limits of what you could do in the sort of GFA Basic interpreter. And when I started hitting those boundaries, that's when we went over and we got our first PC, which was a 386. And my dad being, you know, a math teacher and, you know, he had a physics degree. And so he thought, oh, numbers are important. We had a 387 that came with the 386. We had the dedicated math.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
That we actually spent more money for. And I'm like, great, we'll be able to crunch numbers faster.
Yeah. And people don't realize that the floating point unit used to be an addition.
Yeah, I remember it was like, I think the Pentium was the first one where it was, you know, if you, because some of the 486s had them, some of them didn't. And, you know, me being 12, I had this vaguest notion of what floating point meant and what integer arithmetic went. I just thought, oh, this will be really fast. So I started screwing around with fractals because fractals were cool. It was the, you know,
the 90s. Well, you got to do a Mandelbrot.
Yeah. And so I did a Mandelbrot and I thought, we've got this coprocessor and it's so slow. What's going on? And I was writing everything in C, like using Turbo C at the time. And I thought, why is this so slow? And that's when I started getting into assembly programming just because I sort of wanted this to run faster. And I think that's kind of, you know, if I look back on the point, like when did I start becoming obsessed with performance? It was that point where I went in, I started doing assembly coding and I thought, oh, like, you know, I'm using floating point and we've got the coprocessor, but the coprocessor is still slow. What can I do? Started doing crazy things like fixed point math, writing all this sort of stuff. And I finally got it rendering quickly and I'm like, awesome, this is great. Now what? I'm done. And let's go play some more video games.
I have a similar thing. I was using Turbo Pascal at the time and wanted to make my sprites blit faster in a game. And the great thing about Turbo C and Turbo Pascal was the way you could just drop down into assembly language.
Oh, it was fabulous. It was not only that, I think the huge thing for me too is because, you know, I've got, you know, no patience. Is the REPL. Like, you know, you type something into Turbo C and you'd hit compile and it would compile almost instantly and then you'd run it and you'd be like, oh, cool, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's shaped the way that I program now.
Oh, yeah, no, like it's sort of like you type a few lines, run it. Okay, that still works. Type a few lines, run it. Okay, that still works. And, you know, it seems, you know, there are times where I'm like, is there maybe a better way to be doing this?
Well, some people write a whole bunch and then, like, they've got it all planned out and...
Yeah, I've never been a big fan of planning things, you know. Sort of, you know, let's make this up as we go along. That'll be great. Which is sort of, you know, hurting us now when we get to scale, but that's a story for later on. But no, I mean, back then it was great. You know, you could sort of like, you could experiment with ideas. You could start screwing around with stuff and it was quick. It was immediate. You know, you get that feedback right away. This is working. This isn't working. And I think that's hugely powerful. I think when sort of, you know, I look at some of the stuff, some of the tools today that we use and, you know, like the build times are sort of like, you know, it takes 4 seconds to figure out, oh, what the heck's even going on? And I think back to like, you know, 15-year-old me and I'm like, I would not have had the patience for this.
Right. Yeah. The faster the turnaround, it's the mouse hitting the button to get the endorphin rush.
Mm-hmm. Like, absolutely. Absolutely.
The faster the feedback loop, the more rewarding it is for you, and you know, the more you're going to pursue it.
Absolutely.
So you got into assembly programming on the 387.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit funky.
It was. The thing is that I look back on that and I'm like, how the heck did I, like, you know, do that stuff? Because I can't remember any of it now. It's just all, you know, I look at assembly now and I'm like, hey, what's going on here? But I mean, it was sort of, you know, cobbling together little bits of information here and there. just trying to figure out what worked. And then finally, I remember going back and just doing the fixed point math. And I thought, why doesn't everybody use this? This is great. Not really understanding, oh, there are huge benefits to actually having floating point numbers. Where, you know, like precision and all that, you know, it's, you know, you're dealing with science and numbers and, you know, having the exponent mantissa and all this stuff. And there are use cases where this makes perfect sense and you want that. Whereas opposed to, you know, when you're dicking around with fractals and you're 15, you know, you just want things to work quickly. And you're not going to zoom into like, you know, ridiculous levels of detail. So if your precision falls apart, then who cares? You know, I think I even hit that when I was doing this stuff where I'd zoom in and be like, well, this doesn't look right. Ah, who cares? It's fast. And, you know, go off to the next shiny thing.
So just for people who aren't aware, a fixed point means basically using an integer value and pretending half of it. Let's say you've got a 16-bit integer value. You're probably doing 16-bit at the time, right? Anyway, whatever.
Would I have had access to the 32-bit registers? Yes, I would have. I remember because a friend of mine had a 286 and I said, oh, you can't run this. You don't have 32-bit registers.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So the top, oh, yeah. So anyway, whatever. So you've got the top 16 bits are the, what do you call it?
The whole number?
The whole part. And the bottom 16 bits are the, anything after the decimal. And then you do math on them. And the reason that's faster is because you can just manipulate it entirely in registers on the main CPU rather than going to the floating point unit, which, you know, back in the old days was a bit of a chore.
Yeah.
So, interesting times. I don't think anybody does fixed points anymore.
I think there are times where I know some of the embedded folks do because they don't even have an FPU, but
well, okay,
that may not even necessarily be the case anymore. I mean, the ARM chips that you can buy for a nickel in bulk, I mean, they're pretty much like what used to be in cell phones like 3-4 years ago. You know, they're ridiculously powerful and cheap and power efficient, and it's sort of like, yeah, just run C on there, you're fine.
It's a brave new world. So where'd you go from there? Like, did you follow this into school?
I screwed around with some stuff. You know, there's a point in time where, you know, like computer graphics, I think everybody in like the 90s who was doing this kind of stuff wrote their own like 3D renderer.
Yeah.
You know, did some like stuff like that. And then when I was trying to figure out where to go to school, I was sort of like, you know, well, what do I want to do? And, you know, kind of as I mentioned in the, as Renee mentioned, you know, before we got started, you know, the only thing worse than software is hardware. And, you know, I took electronics too in high school. It was nice because, you know, being out in the middle of nowhere, high school kind of had to cater everything to everyone. So, you know, I could take like the really academic, you know, math courses and on the flip side, learn how to weld. So that also meant that our high school had this really great electronics program. And I remember my high school electronics teacher basically pulled me aside and said at one point, John, you're one of the best students I've ever had in terms of theory, in terms of software. You can't solder to save your life though. Like I do idiot things like, you know, I'd lay out my circuit board. You know, we'd be doing like this simple, like, you know, thing that would run LED lights off of a 555 timer. Mm-hmm. And I would do the board exactly right, except I'd flip the pins for the 555 timer, like one of the 7400 ICs or something like that. And then I'd have to solder on like this extension board that would flip the board around right and do – it was a giant mess. And I'd come out with this project and it would work, but it would be, you know, literally the horrible sort of hack where it's like in software, you're like, oh, I screwed this up, delete, 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 rewrite it and done. So that sort of was my sign that hardware wasn't for me, because, you know, I'd probably do something really stupid like that. And God forbid it would be something in like, you know, a brake control system in a car. You know, I had no interest in touching that stuff. So,
yeah.
When I went to school, it was sort of, you know, I was talking to the folks in engineering, I was talking to the folks in computer science, and I thought, yeah, I think computer science is more my speed. So
sound kind of fun to mess around with that.
It's fun to mess around with, and it's kind of, you know, it's kind of neat. But again, like going back to the whole, like, you know, the fact that I have basically no attention span, you know, the REPL loop there is sort of, you know, you're standing over a vat of like highly corrosive acid you know, and you know, you're doing this in like high school when you don't know any better. You're just standing there, your head's over it. You're breathing in God knows what, waiting for the board to etch. Cause you're like, I just want to start building stuff.
Yeah.
It just takes forever. And it's just, it wasn't for me. I like the immediacy of software. I like the fact that if I make mistakes, I can go in and fix them. And it's not this huge, big, all right, I have to lay out a new board and I have to etch it and I have to do this and I have to do that. So
yeah,
that makes sense. It was just, yeah, it's just, it's, you know, I think part of it too was that, you know, you make a mistake and you start over again. And I was sort of like, hey, you know, I'm happy to make mistakes, but I want to be able to make mistakes cheaply. I want to be able to like fail quickly and then like, okay, like learn from it and move on. We had a, project in our sort of OAC grade 13 where we had a little like, did Intel make the 4004? It was one of their like 8-bit
processors, I think so.
Something like that. And we had a, so they had this built onto a circuit board with a 2-digit display for your address, the two digit, like sort of 7-segment LCD, LED thing, where it would display, you'd get a display for your address, a display for the memory content, and then you'd have a row of like 8 LEDs too. So, I mean, the big thing was to make Knight Rider, like to have the LEDs back and forth with that.
Nice.
But you'd be punching them in on these 4 little dip switches. Like, so you'd like, you know, encode a value, store it to memory, encode a value, store it to memory. And the whole point of this was to do this project where we had to take, write it out in assembly, transcribe the assembly into machine code, and then punch it in. It was kind of like going back to the Commodore 64 where you're like, you know, transcribing this program from the back of a magazine, except you've done every single step of it. So you've got even more places where you can screw up. And I went home and I wrote an assembler because I thought, you know, okay, well, I'm doing, it's a small instruction set. I know which instructions I'm using. Let's encode this so this removes one set of mistakes I can make. And you know, my electronics teacher kind of got upset with me because he's like, well, this isn't the point of the exercise. And I'm like, but I learned more writing the assembler. Plus it's less error prone. It's, you know, I'm a big fan of automating things that, you know, otherwise would be tedious and manual and painful and, you know, more prone to error. So.
And I love Hate the Past so much.
Yeah, it's good times. But you know, it's stuff like that where it's like, it was neat to screw around with, and I'm really glad I did. I have no desire to ever go back to anything like that before. Like the whole idea of, you know, when I was at Intel, like we'd be dealing with beta hardware. We wouldn't even be dealing with like craziness, like, oh, like, you know, the displays are, you know, not working or, you know, like we're doing these like really low level stuff. It's just dealing with hardware that's like, yeah, here are the errata that we're aware of. And, you know, by the way, this could catch fire too. And what the hell? Why are we using this? This seems like a giant waste of time. But, you know, I'm much happier now that for the most part, we are not dealing with, you know, like sort of in development hardware and all that. And we just get to focus on the software side of things.
I'm going to take a quick break so I can tell you about Automatic. Chances are your car hasn't fully kept up with technology. I know that's absolutely true in my case because I bought my car the year before Toyota apparently discovered technology, but that's neither here nor there. Where Automatic comes in is it's just a small adapter that turns any car into a connected car. You plug it into the same port that your mechanic uses to diagnose engine problems, and it opens up a world of possibilities. Automatic lets you keep track of your fuel mileage and vehicle health, expense business trips with a tap, and link your car to the connected devices that power your life. This is so great for me because I am too lazy to do any of those things. Maybe lazy is not the right word. Maybe absent-minded is the word. Whatever it is, I get into a car, I intend to write down fuel mileage and things like that, and then I get out of the car and I haven't. And you know, when that pesky check engine light really means, I just mean think that light means that next time you go to the mechanic, to remind him that that light is there. I don't know. But Automatic tells you before you go to the shop. Automatic can also integrate with your Nest thermostat, if you have one of those, to know when you're home. And it can even provide the answer to one of life's most common questions. Where did I park my car? Because the sight of Renee walking through a parking lot, hitting the unlock lock thing so it beeps and he can find it, almost like echolocation, is just too embarrassing to really get into on this show. Anyway, Automatic works on nearly every car made after 1996. It takes minutes to install and connects to your iPhone or your Android phone over Bluetooth, you get real-time performance data. It uses intelligent coaching to maximize your fuel economy and reduce wear and tear. And that's really important for me because I also drive like a little bit of a really bad driver. You know, I accelerate too fast. I brake too hard. I don't know where I think I'm doing, but I know it's not pretty good for the car. So I welcome this kind of stuff. The dashboard web app provides granular information that lets you export trips. It gives you plain English explanations from your check engine light. Automatic platforms integrate with Nest, Your Mechanic, FreshBooks, and more. You can easily file business expenses with popular apps like Concur and Expensify. You can work with Ifit for even more possibilities to integrate your car into your digital life. When they say connected, they really mean connected. It even supports Apple Watch and Pebble. There's no monthly fee or subscription required, and Automatic never sells your data. So here's what I want you to do. Automatic is normally $99.95. But when you see our special offer code, when you use our special offer code debug, you save 20%. So go to automatic.com/debug for more information and to purchase. Make sure you use our code debug. You'll save 20% off the regular price and you'll make your car completely connected. That's automatic.com/debug. And we thank them for their support.
So you end up in Waterloo.
Yeah, I went to Waterloo, and you know the
for those people who aren't familiar,
Stanford of Canada or the
no, Canada. Stanford is the Waterloo of the U.S. I think is fair.
That is definitely one way you could put it. Except for Waterloo doesn't have a med school.
Oh well, so Montreal's got a med school. We can share it.
Okay, that sounds good. Well, I was at a conference at Stanford last year, and I got a Stanford medicine onesie for my daughter, who was 6 months old at the time.
Oh, I thought you got the onesie. I totally misunderstood.
No. I don't understand the adult onesie thing. Anyway, I got her a little Stanford medicine onesie, and I said to the cashier at the gift store, I'm like, I'm setting expectations early. And he just kind of scowled at me, and I thought, okay. My wife loved it, so that's what's important. So we've said, you know, you're going to medicine, you'll go to Stanford, you know, the Waterloo of the United States, and that'll be great. But yeah, no, I went to Waterloo. You know, I was really impressed with the program there. I mean, I knew of Waterloo. My dad went there to do his physics degree. I was aware of it through all the math contests that Waterloo sponsored. I even went to math camp there. That's just how big of a nerd I was. There was a program where, what was it? Fermat, I think it was the grade 11 contest at the time, where they did something where, you know, they carved Canada up into these regions, like 50 regions or something like that. And the kid who gets the highest score from each region got to go to this math camp. Now, through dumb luck, our region, I went because not because I was the smartest kid in the region, but I like to say I was the least dumb kid in the region. Like, it was just sort of, you know, cows and farmers and whatnot. And so, you know, I got to go to math camp and live on campus for a week. And I thought, this is great. You know, there's all sorts of people doing cool stuff here. And this is where I want to go when I, you know, go off to university. And on top of that, Waterloo's got this great co-op program where you basically spend 4 months in school learning, you know, the theory and such. And then you spend 4 months out of school working somewhere, presumably doing something related to your program. And I was lucky enough that most of my terms on co-op, I had one term where I was kind of doing like IT work and all that. And it was good, sort of, you know, it was like kind of the quote unquote, put hair on your chest, you know, pay your dues kind of work term. But the rest of my work terms, I actually spent doing software development at actual proper software places, which was a really great way of sort of seeing, you know, how sausage is made, so to speak, how big companies actually go. And, you know, you're not dealing with these little like 500, 1,000 line programs that you're sort of writing on your own in your dorm room. You're actually going off and working on multi-million line code bases of products that are used by hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people.
Yeah, that's a big leap when you go from doing your own projects to working in anything that requires a team.
Yeah, even now, like with Geekbench, we hire interns from Waterloo, partially because, you know, it's kind of a paying it forward. I learned a lot from the co-op program, and, you know, it's great to be able to have, you know, kids come through here and pick something up from our code base. And I mean, I think last time I did a line count, we're at about 100,000 lines, excluding, you know, any of the third-party type libraries that we pull in. Yeah. And even still, like the kids that come in, I say, well, it's not that big. We're only at about 100,000 lines. And, you know, their eyes kind of grow wide. Talking about, that's huge.
Yeah.
But you kind of lose that. After working on Microsoft Office, everything seems kind of small and piddly.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Like 100,000 lines seems decent. Like, but not like, I feel that you probably have a good idea about what most of those lines do. With Office.
It was basically I spent 7 years at Sybase after I got out of university on maybe about a million line code base. I want to say I never actually sat down and counted, and it was all nicely compartmentalized. And the project that I worked on, the engine project, maybe 500. I don't know. I can't remember. It was big. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I maybe had an idea of the little tiny chunks that I worked on, what they did. But most of it was just this giant mystery to me.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, at Geekbench, where I've written most of the code, or I've reviewed most of the code that's gone in, or, you know, I've architected the code. And it's sort of a, you know, it's interesting when people come up to me and, like, you know, one of my employees will come up to me and say, yeah, so we've got this bug and I've been banging my head against the wall for like the last like 4 or 5 hours on it. And I'm like, oh yeah, you just need to go sit this variable here and over here and over here, and then you're done. And they're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Off they go. They have no idea what I've said. Meanwhile, I can do this all off the top of my head. It's it's kind of terrifying. I'd be at other companies and I'd look at these people and they'd be able to do the same thing. I'd come to them with a problem and I'd say, like, where do I fix this? And they're like, oh yeah, you just need to go do this and this and this. And I think, holy crap, these people are smart. What am I doing here? And then it's basically just time. You just have to put in the time with the code. And, you know, if you're at some place long enough, you figure out, you know, sort of, so to speak, where the bodies are buried.
Yeah. It's like talking to a cab driver. I know, like, you fly into a city, that guy knows exactly where to go. Doesn't mean that the city is particularly well planned or anything. They just, they know their way around it, you know?
Exactly. Exactly.
One of the things that intrigued me is you say you get a lot of interns from mm-hmm. Waterloo and maybe other places. Do you learn anything from them?
I like to look at it as a we bring them in and it's a different perspective. It's, you know, they sort of they'll come in and they'll do stuff that maybe would have done. They'll do it in a way that I wouldn't have thought of. That especially too, where with C++ kind of going through a little, I want to call it a mini renaissance. The last, like, you know, C++ was kind of this, you know, language we use just because if you want to do cross-platform development, it really, other than it and Java, there's really not a lot else you can use. I mean, you can use C, but you're going to end up doing like re-implementing half of C++ poorly in your project just to make it manageable.
Yes.
If you go past any significant, like, sort of line count.
Yeah.
I remember for the longest time, I thought, you know, I'd love to do something where I can embed, like, you know, Python or Ruby inside of Geekbench. And, you know, we'll call out and, of course, do all the performance intensive stuff in C or C++, you know, the workloads and the stuff that we actually use to measure computer performance. But internally, wouldn't it be nice to use a more modern, a more elegant, a more reasonable language? And since we've switched over to C++ 11, which we're using for the next version of Geekbench, I've stopped thinking that, because a lot of the issues, a lot of the sort of warts in the language have been smoothed over. There's still things that you're dealing with, you know, a very statically typed language. You can't sort of, you know, like Ruby and its duck typing, where it's like, you know, if the class walks like a duck and talks like a duck, we're just going to assume it's a duck and off we go. There are times where I wish I could do stuff like that, which I can't do in C++. But a lot of the other stuff, you know, with the improvements they've made to the standard template library, the improvements they've made, you know, you've got lambdas now, you've got
the auto stuff,
the type inference, even the new the ranged based for loops are great.
Yeah,
and it's just I go into code and, you know, I'm like, oh, this is old code. We'll clean it up and we'll do some stuff with it. That'll.
Yeah, I've been down on C++ for a long time, but I think it's much better now.
It is so much cleaner now. It's insane. I mean, it's at the point where I've stopped wanting to work in other languages. I've stopped sort of wanting to, you know, sort of throw everything out and redo it as something that's a little bit more elegant or a little bit less developer hostile. And now, you know, with all the new stuff in C++ 11, it feels like a new language and it feels a lot more productive. And that's actually one of the things that we've really learned from the interns, because when you're part of my issue has been, you know, when I've worked other places with cross-platform code bases,
especially say Sybase. Sybase worked on this. This was the old Watcom office out of Waterloo. To sort of give sort of a notion of the pedigree of the people that worked there. Watcom, of course, being, you know, the compiler that everybody who was anybody used for DOS development in sort of the late 80s, early 90s.
DOS 4GW.
Exactly. The DOS extender and the Watcom C compiler. And it was just a lot of very, very smart people worked there.
Oh, good. Yeah.
And they
That little lightning bolt on the Watcom thing.
Oh, yeah. Love it. No. And so when they were doing, they also did a database engine called SQL Anywhere. And this was, would have been my, I started there as an intern in 98, I want to say. And I thought, you know, I interviewed with them and they're like, yeah, we're hiring for the Watcom C compiler. And I thought, yeah, I really want to work on the Watcom C compiler because it's so cool and isn't this awesome? Yeah. Not knowing at the time that they were basically winding down that business because it was at the point where Watcom was still a great optimizing compiler. But Microsoft was rapidly catching up with Visual C.
Yeah, but by 98, Windows 95, well, even Windows 98, I guess it was right around the corner. And Wacom was a DOS-centric compiler because it would kick the 386 into 32-bit protected mode, which was like kind of a weird hack on top of DOS. Meanwhile, at this point, Microsoft's Visual C, pretty good. It was coming along. So
yeah, and it was you could still use Watcom to develop Windows apps, but I think there was some things around licensing of MFC, sort of the GUI toolkit that Microsoft put on top of the Win32 API, which was
is Microsoft in the 90s.
So yeah, exactly. It was Microsoft in the 90s. And so they were having trouble licensing that. It was the same sort of problems that Borland had with their C++ compiler, Borland's solution was to make OWL, which never really went anywhere as an alternative.
It was interesting, but
no one used it because it was sort of a, no one got fired for buying Microsoft kind of logic at the time. So anyway, I was there and I was like, yeah, I want to work on the C compiler because, I was being, idealistic 22-year-old me who was like, yeah, technology, woo! And business logic, not so much. And they said, oh, and we've also got this database engine called SQL Anywhere, and it's, low overhead, ACID compliant mobile database. And I thought, well, who cares about databases? Databases are old and boring and stupid. And I got there and I was told, okay, you're on the SQL Anywhere team. And I'm like, oh, for frick's sake. And then I realized you're basically running an operating system. Like the low level, like for a lot of the database stuff, the only way you're going to get reasonable performance out of your system if you're a database engine is if you sort of say to the operating system, no, I know what I'm doing. Just like give me raw chunks of memory. Let me just talk directly to the disk drive. I'll take care of everything. There's all sorts of stuff in there about concurrency, about, file IO, about memory layout, and memory management, and all this stuff. And it was two really interesting work terms. And I went back there when I graduated and I worked there full time for 7 years and did all sorts of cool stuff there then. There was a point cross-platform development. One of the big selling points of SQL Anywhere was not only was it sort of, this nice lightweight database engine that was low maintenance, you didn't need a DBA to run it, you'd still get reasonable performance, was that it ran pretty much everywhere. You had some bizarro Unix variant like HPUX or AIX or something like that, and SQLite would run on it. SQL Anywhere would run on that. That's great. The problem is that running on AIX, running on HPUX, meant that you had to use the vendor compilers, and the vendor compilers were basically either proprietary built in-house compilers or they were really old versions of GCC that just weren't being maintained anymore, which meant your C++ language. I remember we were, when I started there in 2000, one of my first tasks was to sort of provide sort of this resizable, reallocatable sort of, array class. And I thought, oh, well, why don't we just use the standard template library? There's standard vector. It's nice and fast. And people figured out all sort of the performance rough edges. So it should be fairly, performant for what we needed. Well, we can't use templates.
Yeah.
Templates are, this is a fairly, I know they're new-ish in the last 5 years, but they're sort of a well-understood, like, are we concerned about code bloat? Are we concerned about this? Are we concerned about that? And like, oh, half our compilers don't support it.
Yeah.
Oh, OK. okay, so we basically were using C++ as C with classes, which, you know, that still has a lot of benefits for development, but it also meant that a lot of the nice stuff in the language we just didn't use. When I left Sybase, I went to a startup called RapidMind, which was doing GPGPU programming back when GPGPU programming wasn't really a thing yet. Mm-hmm. Basically, they built a language on top of C++ that would let you sort of express operations on vectors or buffers or what have you. And then it would take that at runtime and compile that all down into a GLSL shader program and sort of, you know, run that on the GPU for you. It was a really elegant idea. But in order to do that, they bought full into like the sort of latest bleeding edge C++, you know, template metaprogramming, you know, all the sort of bells and whistles that you sort of expect from, you know, a modern C++ program. And it was a huge mind shift when I went from Sybase to RapidMind. It was just sort of, you know, it felt like a 180. It was from being at a point where don't use all the latest features to use all the latest stuff, use all the whiz bang stuff. Isn't this exciting? And that really opened my eyes. And then when, you know, I started doing Geekbench full time, you know, I was sort of using, you know, what I'd learned at RapidMind in Geekbench and sort of, you know, extending the Geekbench code base that way. But it was our first couple of interns who we had in here who were really gung-ho on C++11 said, well, here's all the stuff you can do. And, you know, oh, Clang's got this cool modernization feature that will update your code base for you. And isn't this neat? So going back to the original question 20 minutes ago, we have learned a lot from the co-ops. And it sort of depends on, you know, what the co-ops backgrounds are. You know, sometimes we get like a first-year kid who's in here and who's, you know, sort of bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and doesn't have a lot necessarily of real-world experience. But at the same time, they might have read up on something or they might have looked at something or even a different perspective on things. That's really useful for us.
Yeah, or just asking a question maybe that triggers.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Like a re-evaluation. It's like, oh yeah, why do we do it like that?
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that for us is really important, I think, is having all these different viewpoints, because when we're sitting down and we're writing benchmarks or we're writing these tests to evaluate computer performance, we've got to think not just how necessarily I use computers or how one of, say, our full-time developers use computers, but also, you know, how would, say, someone who's just in off the street, how are they going to start writing code? Because for the most part, and this is something where I think I have a fundamental disagreement with a lot of people who sort of traditionally write computer benchmarks, is, you know, you've got people at like Spec or from wherever who are, you know, they live and breathe computer performance and that's all they think about all day. And they're writing these very high performance kernels. They're pushing the system to its limits. The vast majority of code doesn't do that though.
An incredibly tiny proportion of code does that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It takes a special mind to be able to write code that tight.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you could probably, if you invited everybody like that to, say, a conference like WWDC, I think you'd still have space left over.
I'm sure.
Like, I'm sure you can measure in like maybe a couple thousand.
Yeah. And that's not a knock. That's just how
it's
specific it is. Like,
it's a very specific skill set. It's because for a lot of folks it's not important. It's not sort of, you know, like people there's the common complaint of like, you know, what was it, what Andy giveth Bill taketh away, the idea for every iteration of hardware, software just gets slower and dumber and it's all these lazy software developers and yada yada. Well,
It's Andy Grove of Intel and Bill Gates from Microsoft.
Exactly. Yeah. This idea that the software developers are sort of, you know, well, like if only software developers worked a little bit harder, and it's not. It's, you know, we've taken, just to pick an example, we have in Geekbench 3 a matrix multiply benchmark, because matrix multiplication is used everywhere for all sorts of cool stuff.
Yeah.
Written in C++, written to be somewhat, you know, not a dumb implementation by any stretch of the imagination, fairly, you know, like cache aware implementation that tries to do the right thing and, you know, respect memory hierarchy and not just basically be a memory bandwidth transfer benchmark. Mm-hmm. That took maybe 2 weeks of effort.
Yeah.
For version 4, we went and we said, screw it. We're going to write the, like, because it was a common source of complaint. People would say like, well, you're getting, you know, 10 gigaflops out of this when the chip can really be able to do 40 gigaflops. you know, you're leaving all this performance on the table. It's not an accurate measure of performance, yada, yada, yada. Fine. Version 4, we're going to write this whole new version. It's going to be as fast as it possibly can. Like, we dropped down, we used assembly for this, you know, all the bells and whistles that we could. You know, we've got specializations for all the major architectures, ARMv7, ARMv8, AVX, AVX2, SSE2, SSE4, all this stuff. I want to say 2 months is what we spent working on those, and they're still not done. I want to say it's an order of magnitude more work to like get something going from pretty fast to really fast.
Yeah. And you know what? You're a benchmarking company.
And
you know, most app companies are just like, I need that working by the end of the day. Like, you've got a day to do that.
You know? Exactly. You've got, and even then, like, you know, the naive matrix multiplication that probably worked well enough for most people is a 10-minute implementation. That's 3-4 loops. It's really straightforward.
Yeah.
The problem is that, you know, most people, they're writing naive code like that. They're writing the really sort of simplistic, like, you know, I'm going to do this. What's a cache? I don't care. I want to ship this so I can get this on the app store and, you know, retire to like Fiji next week.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that just an argument for using sort of platform frameworks that had that kind of thing built in?
There are platform frameworks for certain things. I mean, you know, there are definitely folks at Apple on the Accelerate team who every once in a while sort of, you know, nudge me gently on Twitter and like, hey, we've got all these libraries, why aren't you using them? And you know, like, I nudge back and I say, well, we're cross-platform, you know, I don't want this to be an Accelerate versus, you know, our hand-tuned, you know, ARM benchmark on Android.
But
at the same time, you know, like, for folks who are doing a platform specific app, I don't know why you'd go off and write your own, provided of course those libraries exist. Yeah, the problem, which is when what happens when you wander off the sort of, you know, off the beaten path and there aren't libraries available. That's when stuff becomes a little more tricky and a little bit of more of a gray area. It's like, well, are people going to be running these sort of highly tuned libraries? Or are they going to be sort of relying on their own, you know, ability to sort of write an implementation of an algorithm that they may not fully understand? On an architecture they don't fully understand all the performance pitfalls of, and are they just going to get something that's, you know, fairly smart and not, you know, doesn't have any really obvious big issues?
Yeah.
Or are they going to spend like, you know, 4 weeks and try and optimize the poop out of it?
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, I'll say it this way, but there's some caveats there. Things have changed. Things change quickly in terms of the way, the best possible manner of getting performance out of a particular chip. Often they change along the same vector in that, like, well, this architecture is good at doing this kind of thing. But spending 2 months to get the most out of a particular chip, only, you know, that is basically relevant for maybe 18 months is probably not a good way to spend most people's time.
No, absolutely not. It's a really bad way. But this kind of comes back to us as a benchmark, where do we want to sort of model the, you know, 2 months obsessively tuning for architectures, or do we want to model the whole, you know, I'm spending 10 days on this, maybe.
Right. Like, yeah. Like, the vendors want you to make their chips sound awesome.
Oh, absolutely.
But the real world case is very different.
Exactly. So it's a bit of a balancing game. We kind of try and do both with our benchmarks. We try and have you know, benchmarks that we've written sort of with the idea of, we're not going to do anything obviously stupid. Not that we'd sort of go in and sort of, you know, say, okay, we picked somebody up off the street. We're going to get them to write this, you know, terribly complicated computer vision algorithm, and you know, that'll be that. But at the same time, you know, we're not going to go in and obsessively count cycles and say, you know, could we make this hot loop just that little bit faster? Or, you know, is there some little trick we could use for this particular architecture that may not apply on another architecture? And, you know, once we get down to the point of like where we're splitting out code paths depending on computer architecture, it's like, okay, whoa, let's back up. Is this what we actually want to do for this? Mm-hmm. We do have a couple of those workloads, as I mentioned, that we will do those different code paths for. But for the most part, you know, really, we should just be building, you know, stuff from straight C or C++, because that's how the vast majority of people program these days.
Right.
You know, Objective-C obviously being one of the big exceptions for, you know, iOS and Java on Android. But at the end of the day, you're still going down into system libraries, which are still written in presumably one of those two languages.
Yeah, you don't want to use a lot of Objective-C message passing for each element of the matrix multiplying.
It's interesting whenever I hear someone say, oh, yeah, you know, Objective-C message send is almost as fast as C++ virtual method dispatch. And I'm like, yeah, and you don't use C++ virtual method dispatch.
Right.
Unless you absolutely have to.
But yeah, and I'm a huge Objective-C fan, but don't be a dummy. Like,
yeah,
use it for gluing high level stuff together. And
absolutely.
Know. Yeah. So how did Geekbench, just to rewind a bit, where did that come from? You were at RapidMind at the time, I imagine.
I was at Sybase. And I had drunk the Apple Kool-Aid. I'd gone out and bought myself a PowerBook G4 on almost a whim in 2002. It was the height of the sort of, you know, I was commuting back and forth. I had a 45-minute commute. And I was getting sick of my audio cassette player in my car. And I thought, I'm hearing things about these digital music players. So I went into my local Future Shop and said, I want a mini disc player. And the guy at Future Shop.
That's brilliant forward looking of you. Yeah.
Basically, you know, like there's this new thing. It's called the iPod. You want to go down the road to the local Apple, you know, store. They'll be able to set you up and yada, yada. So I walked out with an iPod and a MacBook, PowerBook. Kind of went like, oh, okay, like, you know, why don't I try this? Because I mean, I've been hearing a lot more about the Mac, and people were saying, you know, a lot of the issues with sort of the Mac OS, where it's, you know, like cooperatively multitask, there's no memory protection. This is all fixed. It's all Unix under the hood. Isn't this cool? And yeah. I've been hearing a lot of people say, yeah, this is really exciting. I've switched and, you know, from Windows to the Mac, or I've upgraded from classic Mac OS to, you know, Mac OS 10, and this is really much, much better, and it's much cleaner, it's much more elegant. I thought, oh, okay, I'll try this out. So I'd been using the PowerBook for a while, and ended up doing the Mac port at work and of our software, and getting, you know, SQL Anywhere to run on the Mac and that sort of stuff. And so when WWDC came around, this was back in 2003, when, you know, Apple was having trouble filling the room. And they basically, somebody somewhere got a call and said, hey, you guys are doing some Mac software. Maybe you'd like to send one of your developers to the conference. So I got to go to WWDC, and that's when the G5 was announced. And this was all very, again, more excitement, big and exciting. And 64-bit isn't cool. And I thought, oh, this
G5, is... Yeah. G5 was and still is a fascinating chip.
It's such an interesting point in sort of, you know, the evolution of computers, because in some ways it's such a, I mean, PowerPC as an architecture was so incredibly elegant. I mean, I look back at that stuff and AltaVec, and it was nice, it was neat, it was clean, and oh my goodness, was it slow.
Those long pipelines were killing it.
Oh, I know. It was insane. Because so anyway, this is what happened was I went out and I got myself a G5. Because I wanted the desktop. I was, as much as I loved my PowerBook, there just wasn't enough space on there. And I kept on running out of hard drive space, because I think I had a 20 gigabyte hard drive. And I kept running out of space for it, because I was ripping everything into iTunes, and isn't this amazing? And I've got the iPod, and woo, digital music revolution, and all that fun stuff. And so I went out and I got, you know, the low-end Power Mac G5, which had the 1.6 gigahertz G5 in it. And I ran a benchmark. The popular Mac benchmark at the time. And it said it was significantly slower than my PowerBook. And I thought, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. What's going on here? So I ended up reverse engineering the benchmark and finding out what it was doing, because I thought, there's no documentation on it. It's like, we're measuring integer performance. And I thought, what the heck does that mean?
Right.
So I went in and I, you know, used all it was. I used all the great developer tools that don't ship anymore, stuff like Shark, and all that.
Oh man, Shark was beautiful.
I love that so much. Instruments is nice, but it's, I feel like it's only now getting to the point where it was sort of where Shark was,
10,
15 years ago.
Yeah, Shark was hardcore though. Like,
it was, but I mean, Shark, you could run Shark on something, and get. I feel like you could run it And in 10 minutes, you could have actionable feedback that you could actually go out and go, okay, this is what I have to go do.
Yeah, I don't think that was true for the majority of the developer base.
No. I would say, okay, so...
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I mean, it's...
You know?
As much as I know I'm definitely, you know, like for low-level stuff, ahead of the curve here, Shark, I felt like, was... Or maybe, you know, like my perception of what the average developer can do is completely skewed and I'm just, you know, completely on the moon. But I felt Shark was sort of like you ran something. It gave you, it instrumented stuff and it was like, this is where it stops slow. This is the loop. Here it is in the source code. You need to think about this. Whereas instruments, I mean, you still have to go and it's like, you know, try and remember what the counter is for Haswell on this particular machine so that you can go and add it in instruments and find out where your hot loop is. And it's like, oh my goodness, no one's got time for this.
Really?
Yeah. So you reverse engineered the benchmark. Use Shark, reverse engineered it, and I found out the benchmark was basically doing the greatest common divisor of 2 4-digit integers. It was one of the simplest, it was the naivest benchmark I'd seen, and I thought, well, screw it, I can do something better than this. So I patched something together and, you know, just threw some sort of, I tried to do stuff that I could think of off the top of my head. There was a Mandelbrot benchmark in there, because of course fractals. There's some other, like, you know, some compression stuff. I can't even remember what the full mix of stuff was, and I put together some stuff, ran it, and the G5 was still slow. And I thought, oh, well, this is interesting. And then shelved it. and then kind of came back to this in a couple of years because I was doing some cross-platform analysis. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be really nice if there was a benchmark that you could run on the Mac, a benchmark you could run on the PC, and it would show you sort of comparative numbers for that. Sort of say, like, you know, this is how fast your Mac is, this is how fast your PC is. Because, you know, you had the issue of the Macs were running PowerPC chips, Windows machines were running Intel chips, and there was no real good way to compare them one to one. So I spent some time on this, polished it up, just shipped it off as a command line application, and then Apple announced they were switching to Intel. I'm like, well, this is great timing on my part. You know, and sort of everybody was like, well, you know, and this was at the point when Apple was saying sort of what most people, I think, who knew about performance already had kind of figured out, was that PowerPC was way behind. That Intel was far ahead and switching to Intel would like result in this big boost. And, you know, looking at the Geekbench numbers at the time, that all collaborated what it said. And,
you could get Ultivex in.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like you could
if you
did exactly what the power, the G5 was meant to do.
If you had one of those niche, workloads where you could really get it to shine, It would work and it would work beautifully.
Yeah. Problem is, guess what?
Yeah.
Software didn't do that.
it's sort of the issue that we have now where Intel's scaling up vector widths, where you've gone from SSE where you've got four lanes to AVX where you've got 8 lanes, and they're now talking about AVX 512 where you'll have 16 lanes. The problem is, what can use a 16-lane vector? Instruction. Very few applications.
I can't actually think of many. Image processing, probably.
Yeah, there's some image processing stuff, but even then, like, you're going to get killed on the boundaries. And if your image isn't in the first place, then, you know, you're not going to get that much of a win out of it. And on top of that, the interesting thing is that they're talking about with these instructions, your register file, whenever you context switch, is now dwarfing the size of the caches.
Oh,
512 byte vector registers that whenever you context switch, you have to stash somewhere. And that's killing. It's such an interesting problem from Intel's side of things, but it's kind of like increasing core counts and chips. There comes a certain point where, you know, Intel, I'm sure, could ship a mobile chip that had 8 or 16 cores in it. Mm-hmm. And that's all well and good, but most software is single threaded still.
Well, a 512-bit register set seems, I don't know. I can't think of software that will actually leverage it. And you're paying every app, every context switch is paying the cost.
Exactly.
That seems like a poor trade-off to me.
think this is only coming out on some of their high-end Xeon chips, which makes me think they're targeting this at high-performance computing, like the oil and gas simulations, the atomic simulations, that sort of thing, where they basically need every single ounce of performance they can get out of the processor. And I don't honestly think this will even appear in the core chips. So, I mean, it's not like you're going to be able to go out and buy a Mac that will have, AVX 512 enabled in it anytime soon.
Especially not a Mac Pro.
I would love to see a new Mac Pro. I made the mistake of on Twitter last week, right after the announcement came out for the media event on, what is it, the 21st?
Yes.
Saying, oh, new Mac Pros, without any context in it, thinking, who actually listens to me? The next thing I know, apparently started a rumor that there'll be new Mac Pros coming out. So that was sort of my nice little lesson on, like, watch what you say on Twitter. I'd love to see new Mac Pros. I mean, we've got one in the lab here. I'd love to go out and buy a couple more so that we can sort of have more test machines, and because they're ridiculously fast. It's not even just the CPU, but the I/O and the GPUs are just, they're great. They're such nicely engineered machines. I have a hard time. Sorry, go ahead.
I think they're brilliant. I just don't think that most software uses, or I don't think most software is suitable for leveraging the power.
No, I mean, I'd love to see a Mac Pro with one GPU.
I think
the two GPUs is overkill for the vast majority of things out there. There are definitely use cases where that's interesting, where having that extra GPU, I think some of Apple's Pro apps use that second GPU quite extensively. But I think for most applications, it's just no one cares. But the flip side of it is that, having an 8 to 12 core Mac with that really fast I/O, I mean, they're great developer workstations. They're great. I used one as my main developer workstation for a while, and I was doing some work on our website, the Geekbench browser, which is the online database of all the performance results. And I was doing stuff on my development system, and I'm like, oh, this is really nice and fast. Let's push it to production. And it would just be slow as really, really slow as molasses. And I'd look at it and I'd be like, well, what's going on? Oh, I've got so much spare I/O bandwidth here.
Mm.
I think the Mac Pro was one of the first ones to ship with a PCIe flash.
Yeah.
I was using, we're hosted on a VPS with just sort of, I think, SATA flash, and just the performance difference is night and day. Mm-hmm. Something that would take an hour on our VPS takes maybe 4 minutes on the Mac Pro.
Wow.
It's impressive. They're great machines. I'd love to see them either updated, because I have a hard time paying, as I was saying, $4,000 for a chip that's effectively 4 years old and graphics cards that are roughly the same vintage. I mean, they're still quite fast. And unfortunately, desktop isn't like mobile. Desktop performance has kind of plateaued over the last few years. So I mean, going to Haswell E or Broadwell E instead of Ivy Bridge. So, earlier micro architecture, older process nodes, so you're not getting quite the energy efficiency, you're not getting all the new features that you might get in the newer chips. And the older FirePro cards, it would be nice to have an upgrade for that, especially when you're paying that sort of level of premium price. But I mean, the enclosure, the thermals, it's just such a wonderful machine to work with. And it's even a wonderful machine to work around, because the thing is whisper quiet.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, it's my main machine.
Even when you're running Arkham and Tomb Raider on each of the cards, it's still quiet.
Yeah, when I got it, I just ran all of the video games at once.
Did you get the fan to turn on?
In the middle of the summer, playing a game, yeah. I got the fan to turn on. But it's actually next to, I've got two Drobos next to it, and they make way more noise than my Mac Pro.
I got rid of our, I remember when the Drobo came out, I thought, this is such a clever idea. You really want to sort of abstract away this notion of RAID, and I just want to shove drives in an enclosure and call it a day. And then I got my first Drobo, and I thought, holy crap, this is loud. I must have gotten a defective one. So I took it back, got a new one, and it was just as loud. And I thought, well.
Have you tried it with SSDs yet? I mean, I know it's pricey, but.
Yeah, no, I ended up getting rid of it and just going to one of the, Synology NASs. And we've now got three of them in the office here. And they've been, we've got a rack mount one that's a little noisy, but it's rack mount. I mean, you know, we've got a dual socket Opteron system that's rack mount. We turn it on and basically, you know, it sounds like a jet engine's taking off in the office. So. Yeah. You know, a little.
That's okay though. I'm okay if you know if it's going to be rack mounted.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, fine. Yeah. Uh-huh. The second gen Drobo is way quieter than the first gen Epcot. As a random data point, I think they've been getting better at it. But.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a neat concept. It's just I feel like they cheaped out in the worst possible way by using the cheapest fan they could find.
Yeah,
well, because there was at the time there. I remember there were all these articles that said basically, you know, take apart your Drobo, kiss your warranty goodbye, but put in the, you know, it's a stock fan with a stock connector. Pull it out, plug in this new one that costs maybe $1, and you'll have a much better experience.
Well, good hacking tip.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, hey, just rip apart the $500 enclosure. For a $1 fan, and you have no warranty anymore. Good luck.
Yeah, hopefully do that before you get any data stuck in there. But
yeah, exactly.
So you're at Sybase, you get Geekbase going. Then you're at RapidMind. Geekbench. Then you're at RapidMind. When does Geekbench become your gig?
So an interesting thing happened at RapidMind. So we were sort of chugging along and we were doing, as I said, you know, we'd abstracted away this GPGPU thing. And at the time, really the only way to take advantage of your GPU was to write GLSL, which depending if you had an NVIDIA card or an AMD card were completely different. So, you know, we had this value proposition where it's like, write code and it will run on your GPU regardless of like, you don't have to worry about what actual card you're running. We'll just take care of that for you. We'll do, because it's all like, it was all syntactic BS basically was, you know, NVIDIA wants this, well, AMD wants that. It was something that was really easy to sort of say, okay, well, here's our NVIDIA cogen path. Here's our AMD cogen path. They can share a lot of stuff. We just have to know we have to prefix this with that or that with this and that. Made it work really well. And we were able to get some really good performance out of them, which was really exciting. And then I remember I was sitting in my cube, it was 2008, and listening to the WWDC keynote on my headphones, and they start talking about GPGPU, and I'm like, yes, finally, other people are listening. Oh, that's nice, Apple released OpenCL. And I thought, well, we're done. Let's just pack up and go home now. And this was also like the recession had hit, and you know we funding was becoming tighter and all this stuff, so... I thought, I'm really curious to see where we end up. So about a year later, we got bought out by Intel. They were doing their own initiative internally to do something very similar to what RapidMind was doing. Just more focused on CPU, obviously, than GPU. They wanted to make multi-core programming easier because this was at the point in time where people were saying, you know, chips were coming out, you know, dual core chips came out and then quad core chips came out and everybody was talking breathlessly about 8 and 16 and 24 core chips. I have a slide somewhere that showed basically the estimate being like for 2016 that we'd be all running 32 core chips in our laptops or something. Which, because, you know, now it looks completely insane. But, you know, back then in 2008, 2007, 2009, people were saying like, well, this might be the new future. Like it might be, you know, we're plateauing single core performance. How do we get more performance out of this?
Now my laptop has Core M. Take that, future predictors.
Yeah, exactly. Throttling, you know, dual core. So Intel wanted to make, you know, multi-core programming easier and they had some great technologies like threading building blocks, but, you know, they wanted something where like more of this data parallel approach that RapidMind was pushing. And so they bought out RapidMind. At the same time, I have, as my side project, Geekbench. which put me in a really interesting position because here I am with this independent benchmark app going to go work for the world's largest semiconductor manufacturer. So I remember sort of sitting there and, you know, having, you know, we were told of this and I sort of said, well, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? And, you know, I talked about it with my wife and I talked about it, you know, a little bit with some friends of mine. And they said, well, declare the conflict of interest because there obviously is one.
Yeah.
And hopefully people will get it. And at the time, I mean, we were really only at this point in time, I'm thinking like 2009. Mobile hadn't really taken off yet. So most people comparing the benchmarks were, you know, Intel versus Intel. And so, you know, I wrote a blog post and basically said, you know, like a month after the acquisition and said something to the effect of, you know, hey, this is where things are. You know, trying to keep these as separate as I can. This is, you know, as much as this is a side project, it's a side project I take very seriously, you know, no undue influence and that sort of thing. And I think the sole amount of influence that Intel ever exerted over me in terms of Geekbench was they were aware of the project, and they were sort of aware that it was this thing, but they just didn't care. Like there'd be the odd time somebody might reach out to me through work and say, "Yeah, Bob from this place told me that you're the Geekbench guy and that we should talk to you about something," and I'm like, "I would be happy to talk to you when I'm not sitting at my desk at Intel. You know, call me this evening," or something like that. The odd time. And it was always like just softball kind of questions like, oh, like we're using Geekbench internally. How do we use this command line flag or something like that?
Yeah.
Well, it was never a, we want you to make us look better. So it was fine. It was never a big deal.
Yeah. That's good.
But
I would actually be surprised if they tried to mess with you, not mess with you, but encourage you to skew Geekbench. It seems kind of productive and petty for a company that big. You know,
people do weird things with benchmarks. I mean, there have been in the mobile side of things, there have been a few instances of companies doing things with mobile benchmarks that maybe they shouldn't have. So, I mean, I think anything's possible. Yeah. But
I do know, like in the GPU side, people will gin up drivers to.
And they'll do crazy stuff on the CPU side of things as well.
Okay.
Especially considering, you know, how important power and thermal management is and governors. And if you, you know, relax the governors or if you increase your thermal headroom when you know a benchmark's running, you can get slightly better scores. Like there have been instances of this. But for the most part, like the nice thing was when I was at Intel, I was pretty much left alone. As I said, like the some extent of my interactions were usually just a, hey, we're using it. This is great. How do I do X? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, like do this instead of that. Oh, cool. Thank you. Like basic customer support type stuff.
Right. Yeah. Which, you know, fair enough.
Yeah. But
eventually you decided that you.
Yeah. So it was, I'd been there for about 2 years and, my wife got an offer to go. We were living in Waterloo at the time, and my wife got an offer to go. She's a medical research type person. She does stuff. I nod and smile and, you know, pretend I know what she's talking about. But she got an offer to do her postdoctoral fellowship over on the West Coast.
Cool.
And that was kind of at the point where I sat down and talked to my manager at Intel, because we were just happened to be going to Portland, and there's a big Intel presence out there. And I said, hey, I'm going to Portland. Wouldn't this be exciting? BT Dubs, like, what do I do about my job here? And, you know, they chatted it over and they said, well, you know, like, we'll support you if you want to move and find a different position. But, you know, we can't just, like, I was doing kind of a scrum / program manager type job. I was scrum master / program manager / some other things. One of the PM type roles.
Yeah,
I'd stopped doing development. They took away my commit access.
Wait, really? You couldn't commit it?
No. It was one of those things. I was in meetings all day. So
yeah.
You know, that was the joke. It's like, you don't want me coding because I'm gonna make a bad situation even worse. I said, you know, I understand. Like, you know, I'm very much like sort of face to face, but we do have a distributed team. Like, what can we do? And they sat and they thought about it, and they're like, well, we'll support you if you want to move, but you're going to have to find a new role in a team, because you can't really work for us and do this role when you're going to be offsite. Because as much as we were a distributed team, we had people in Vermont, we had people in Vancouver, we had people in Portland, Oregon. The 2/3 of the team was actually on site in Waterloo. So having somebody that spent a lot of FaceTime with these people suddenly move and be remote, they were worried that that just wouldn't work. So they said, you know, if you want to find a new job inside of Intel, that would be great. Otherwise, we can't support your move. So, you know, my wife and I talked about it and I crunched the numbers on Geekbench and I'm like, this is starting to approach not what I'm making, but enough that we could live off of it. Mm-hmm. So when we moved to Portland, I just sort of, you know, I handed in my notice at Intel and basically said, you know, thanks for the fish, but off I go. And decided just to do sort of, it was like moving to Portland was the kick in the pants for me to take this full time. And that would have been 2011. So I've been doing this now. As of May, it will have been 5 years full time.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't sound like a lot, but when you figure the sort of devices we had even just 5 years ago, it's almost been a massive shift since then.
The iOS version of Geekbench was on the App Store for less than a year at that point. There was no Geekbench for Android. There was no Geekbench for BlackBerry 10, but the less said about that, the better.
Canadian heart.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we were barely in mobile at all. Like, we were still doing version 2. It's become a very different landscape. I mean, no one really outside of the Mac community, like we've just because of my personal computing preference being, you know, Mac OS 10, because you've got sort of, I like to kind of think of it as Linux that works.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you've got the nice Unix underpinnings where you've got bash and you've got all this great scriptability, and the Unix philosophy is sort of, let's chain a bunch of little programs together. Whereas, say, maybe on the Windows side of things, you've got this monolithic idea of like, we're going to have one application that does everything. It's going to be awesome. Well, it doesn't support this. Well, too bad. You're screwed. You know, it's one of the issues we hit here all the time where it's like, oh, we can do this by chaining together these three things. You know, we'll SSH into the server and we'll run this, that, and the other thing, and we'll be good. What do we do for Windows? Well, we're screwed. All right, back to the drawing board. You know, just working with a Mac, it feels like a much cleaner, much more pleasant experience just because of the fact that you've got bash and all these great command line tools. Xcode's great. I mean, I love Visual Studio as well. I think they're great, both great tools.
Yeah.
Just the command line experience on OS X is head and shoulders above what it is on Windows. Yeah. But so that's where a lot of our focus has been, at least in our early years, was just simply like looking at Macs and looking at Mac performance, because that's what I really cared about. So, you know, when I went full time in 2011, I think we were viewed as a Mac benchmark. Sort of, you know, yeah, we've got a Windows version, but no one really pays attention to it. And yeah, we've got a Linux version, but no one really pays attention to it. Now in 2016, I think people turn to us as a mobile benchmark more than anything. You know, we definitely still produce desktop versions, but I mean, all of our growth, all of our interest has been in Android and iOS. And that's just stepping back and thinking about it. I remember I was talking to Chris Lisieux about this ages ago, and he's like, you should do a version for iOS. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, the iPhone 3G had either just come out or was just about to come out. And I thought, no one's running anything, you know, processor intensive on their
phone. If only Lisieux were smarter. I mean, just imagine what he could do.
Exactly. But I remember thinking at the time, like, you're silly. Like, this, no one's really going to care. Who's going to buy a benchmark on mobile? Like, there's no upgrade path. There's no this, there's no that. And when I finally broke down, this would have been 2008, when I finally broke down and did it in 2010, and I saw the sales numbers for the first day, I thought I was going to faint. why have I dragged my feet for so freaking long? Like, basically, like, I remember we just kind of put it out there. I threw an app together. It was literally, if you Google Geekbench 2 iOS and look at the images, it is the ugliest iOS app ever. it's the pinstripe with the table view and an HTML view that's got no styling applied to it whatsoever. It's basically a click a button and you get a number. Hey, this is great. It really is a geeky application.
Yeah.
But I mean, we got covered left, right, and center for it. Like, hey, here's a benchmark. You can compare your desktop and your phone. And I thought, oh crap, this is really good. So, yeah, that's sort of what kicked us into mobile. But even with that, like getting it on Android was a pain in the butt because Android this time didn't support C++. If it did, you could kind of, you know, call into C, but your C++ environment was really stunted. It took a year and a half for us until it basically got to the point where it was good enough that we could actually bundle our, you know, because we're using all this cool C++ features like templates, which are really strange and complicated. In 2012, until like January 2012, we launched on Android, and that took a lot of fighting. Google had this mindset of you're only going to write apps in Java. No one else wants, you know, only Java. Java everywhere. Java. And
is that because they wanted to keep the cross-platform thing, or well, not just, cross-platform, but have the ability to swap out?
I think that's where they wanted to go, and I think that's what they really wanted to. They sort of looked at it as, you know, they're on ARMv5 now. ARMv7 is right around the corner. Intel, I'm sure, is making noises about making their own chips for smartphones at the time. They support MIPS, which I think outside of China, no one's using MIPS in devices.
Well, PSP used MIPS. I'm not sure what Vista uses. Probably, I think it's an ARM chip. Yeah,
I'm not sure either. But I mean, like MIPS in, I remember when I saw like the NDK said, oh, we now have MIPS support. I thought, really? Who's using that?
Why would you?
And aside from some devices in China, I mean, because I think it's, China's got the Longsun processor where they've licensed the architecture. They've licensed the instruction set, but they've made their own chip.
Okay. Yeah.
Something like that. Anyway. So yeah, I mean, there's MIPS support. But the question is, you've got, if you don't have a native binary, so let's say I build an app and I build it for ARMv7. You try and run it on an ARMv5 chip, it won't work. You try and run it on an Intel chip, it won't work. What's their approach to that? Well, I think Google for the longest time said, well, write everything in Java and that will be wonderful. The problem is that you have an iOS app. Let's say you've got this big collection of cross-platform code that you've maybe dragged from Windows or you've dragged from another platform that is all written in C or C++. Well, how do you get that onto Android? For the longest time, you just didn't. Then I think Google finally realized, crap, we're going to have to support this. And so over time, their native development kit, the NDK, just kept getting better and better and better. And it got to the point where you could finally use most of C++. And then that got to the point where we could finally get onto the phone and then go from there.
Do you know if that was pressure from game developers?
I don't know who it was pressure from, because it sort of seemed to, I didn't have a lot of visibility into that at the time, so I'm not sure. The Android community, the development community, I find is very fragmented. I'm not sure. I find OS, the Mac OS and the iOS communities tend to be much more coherent, where it's sort of, you know, it's a, you go and talk to like one of like, you know, somebody and they probably, everybody's kind of clued into roughly the same idea. And I don't know how much of that is just something about the community, how much of that is that it's Apple and Apple is the, you know, Apple is this wonderfully vertically integrated development platform, and Apple gets messaging right. They sort of say, this is the future, go forward, do this. Mm-hmm. Whereas on the Google side of things, you're dealing with, well, Google makes the operating system, and Google makes the developer tools, but then you've got 200 maybe smartphone vendors using chips from 20 different chip vendors. And components from who knows where else. And it's just, you can't help but be fragmented at that point.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. This is a bit of a weird segue, but speaking about weird fragmentation, the most recent iPhone had, what was it, two different manufacturers of the same
chip. Taiwan Semiconductor and Samsung.
Yep.
So that was a bummer.
It was.
Can you explain that? Because that got stupid really quickly, I think.
This kind of caught us by surprise. We introduced a battery test in December 15th, 2014. The only I remember that date is I was basically up till 4 in the morning getting that shipped. Because my wife had a scheduled C-section that morning, and I knew if I didn't ship it then, it wasn't going to get shipped for months. So,
congratulations.
Yeah, exactly. It was a fun day. I was like, I shipped an update, and I had a daughter. It was great. you know, I joke, I started off right by being sleep deprived. so the next 2 days were a bit of a blur, but, so we did this battery test and you know, we talked to some, we've got a benchmark development program that we run where we get input from different hardware vendors and we basically bundle up our source code in our pre-release state, toss it over the wall and say, have a look, let us know what you think. So we talked to some hardware vendors and said, you know, like we kind of want to start measuring power because we think power is important. It's nice that you've got this really fast chip, but if it drains the battery super quickly, then who cares? So, you know, we sort of had this little experimental kind of ish battery test that ran, you know, relatively modern smartphones at about 30 to 50% of their duty cycle. So the chip would run at full tilt for 30 to 50% of the time, and then the rest of the time it would stay idle. It's kind of like the burstiness of, like, you know, if you're running a video game, the chip will run quickly, figure out what it needs to render for the frame, and then hopefully be able to sneak back to idle for a little bit so that you can, you know, keep your thermal headroom from exploding and all that stuff. So we shipped this, and there was some, you know, it has usability problems. It's one of the things that the idea of going from our traditional benchmark, which runs in a minute or two, to this benchmark that will take hours to run. We didn't figure out all the UI problems, and we kept thinking, we'll fix it for four, kick the can down the road, let people keep using it. You know, and some journalists, like, you know, the folks at Ars Technica played around with it and said, hey, this is really great. This, you know, might be a nice compliment for our battery test in the future, yada, yada, yada. You know, it kind of like goes back to the idea of us trying to provide tools that, because this was always one of my big pet peeves, going on in yet another segue. When magazines or articles, I think Macworld was bad about this, where they're like, we've got this great suite of tests that we run that, you know, we think models real world usage. Well, that's great. It's proprietary and you can't run it yourself. Well, that sucks. Because one of the things is that we found is that, you know, I'd always sort of, you know, you get a new computer and I always ran a benchmark on it first thing because I wanted to make sure that it was performing properly. And I thought, you know, I'm kind of an oddball doing this, but no, this is what a lot of people use benchmarks for. They want to make sure that what they just bought works.
That isn't a lemon.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to find out, oh, my processor is running at half the speed. One of my
friends, 'cause that happens. I mean, some people do occasionally get a bad unit.
There was a friend of mine who bought one of the first gen Retina MacBook Pros, and his heatsink was cracked in half.
Ouch.
So it basically ran no faster than, you know, like a PowerPC iMac. And, you know, but he found that out through Geekbench. So, you know, hey, this is great. It's a great diagnostic tool.
But when I imagine it's sort of like, at least in the analytic world, we gave people a ton of tools, but they would read into it what they wanted because you need training to use all these new tools.
Right, exactly. And there's definitely, you know, I don't want to say that there's absolutely no value in running something like Photoshop or something like this or something like that. Because, you know, a lot of the time, like part of the problem we have as a sort of general purpose benchmark is what do we include in our suite of tests? Like, what do we measure? Because, you know, we don't want to take forever to run. We've got, you know, there are licensing issues. It's not like I can go up to Adobe and say, hey, you know, it'd be so cool if you gave us the source code to Photoshop. What do you think? I'm pretty sure they'd kick us out on our duff. But that would be really cool because it would be sort of like, you know, for a lot of people when they're buying new fast computers, they're trying to do Photoshop. They're buying it to do Photoshop. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why we've got image processing tests in Geekbench is because, you know, hey, photo manipulation, that's huge. But, you know, when you're a magazine or something like that, you can publish a suite of tests where it's like, you know, you're using Word or you're using Photoshop or using, you know, applications that people actually use. That's really powerful and really compelling because you can say, you know, hey, here's Photoshop gets 15% faster on this new iMac. You know, if that 15% is important to you, then, you know, go out and get the new iMac. Whereas us, we're kind of a lower level and we're like, hey, you know, like this operation runs faster. So this might correlate to faster Photoshop performance. We can't really say. The flip side of it is that Geekbench is like this, you know, 30 megabyte download that you hit one button, run, and you get a number out of, and you can go and refer to that elsewhere, you know, on our website or wherever, or your friends or your old machine or something like that, and find out sort of like, oh, okay, like, you know, the numbers are where they're supposed to be. So that's one of the things that I really like about our approach to it is that we're giving people a tool that they can run easily on their own machine to make sure that their machine is working how it's supposed to be working. And that's one of my big concerns about sort of the big benchmark suites is that makes it very difficult to do.
Yeah.
I have lost my train of thought. Where was I going with this?
The A9 difference between the
So we had this battery test, and we thought, you know, it'll be kind of interesting. People compare it. You know, we're trying to make something that's easy to use, but it's also hard because battery discharge tends to be nonlinear. You can't just sort of take a sample of it and go, okay, well, it took 10 minutes to, you know, drop 10% charge, so that means it'll take 100 minutes to completely discharge. There's usually nonlinearity at both ends, like fully charged and fully discharged. That's hard to account for. So, you know, so anyway, we've got this battery test. It's got some usability issues, but if you know how to use it, you can kind of get some good numbers out of it. The new iPhone comes out, and it's using two sources of chips. And that's really cool because it's the first time I've ever been able to walk into an Apple store and say, I would like to buy a new iPhone on the day of the launch. And they say, sure thing, here you go. Off you, then, you know, without reserving or lining up for all day, like they're able to meet all the demand, which is amazing. I want to say 2-3 weeks later, people start running Geekbench's battery tests and say, you know, the TSMC chip's getting much better battery life than the Samsung chip. And I remember hearing that and going, what? That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. What's going on here? And the sort of, you know, the long and the short of it was the best we could figure was in certain circumstances, the Samsung chip would use more power than the TSMC chip, which caused it to throttle faster, which caused it to use more power, which caused lower battery life, that sort of thing. The big question was, when does that matter? And we some sort of, just through the design of our battery test, we hit some very bizarre sweet spot where we really demonstrated this problem. If we'd been lower utilization or higher utilization, we probably wouldn't have, we would have measured a difference, but it would have been much smaller. We just hit some bizarre, like it was almost like, I'd almost term it perfect storm. Mm-hmm. Where it's just, it was the right level of utilization across the right number of cores in the right sort of application. Had we been doing more GPU centric, we may not have hit that. Had we been using more, had we been more storage based or radio based, we may not have hit it in the same way. I think we just found a really weird difference between the two chips, and we just,
you hit it where it hurt.
Exactly. And it was one of these areas where it was like, we showed a big difference, but for most people, they'd never hit that difference in practice.
I forget, but the way it was described to me is that if you take two sprinters and you, in order to make the Canadian Olympic team, American Olympic team, if you're in the States, mm-hmm. you have to get under 9 seconds in the 100-meter yard dash. Both these sprinters get there. One might be faster off the blocks. One might be better in the long stretch. One of them might have some ups and downs along the way. Mm-hmm. And one of them might be dependent on the track conditions, but they all made the Olympic team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it's just, it's for the way that for us, it was sort of a, you know, we were, you know, let's say you've got a sprinter who's fast off the block and another one who's slow but speeds up. And, you know, they're running a 100-yard dash. And we're like, okay, we're going to look at the performance of them when they're at 30 yards. Yeah. And it's not necessarily that that's the wrong thing to look at. It just might be a, are we taking a, is it just through some weird subsection of what we're viewing? That, you know, as an automatic test that sort of, you know, runs unattended, there's only so much we can do. And we just happened to hit this really bizarre point where, you know, we just show this huge difference. You know, we found other cases where there was a difference, but the difference wasn't as pronounced, or the difference wasn't even there. It just, you know, the more we dug into it, the more we looked at it, and we're like, yeah, this is an issue with the chips, but, you know, effectively, I don't think it's going to bother anybody. And as, you know, it flared up and it died out pretty quickly.
And if they'd used Samsung across the board, nobody would have noticed anything.
Nobody would have noticed it. Because, I mean, the other thing was, too, is that the A9, as much as there was an issue with the Samsung chips, both were better than the A8.
Yeah.
So it was a really weird month for us when we were going through that, because we were getting, you know, pinged left, right, and center. You know, what's going on? Is this a problem with Apple? And it's sort of, you know, you could tell based on, you know, who we were talking to or something, is like, you know, some people are like, oh, this is an issue at all. Or other people are like, yeah, like, you know, let's grind the axe.
And some people just want to make you into the bending phone guy.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just sort of like, it's just not something I wanted to be. That's not something I wanted to really be. I mean, you know, we sort of look at this. It's like, it's a tool. It gives you a number. We try and provide as much context for you that you can put that number into like something meaningful for you. But at the end of the day, like, you know, we try and remain as neutral as possible when it comes to this stuff.
Yeah, I think that was an unfortunate. I mean, that is the trap of benchmarks, or not the trap. It's the difficulty of a benchmark, right? Is that, like you were saying at the top, you can fine tune code to get the most performance out of everything. But what you really want to do is measure what it means for the person using the device.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, well, whatever. You hit a sinkhole. Like
it does show weird
anomaly between the two chips. But I mean, that doesn't mean it doesn't mean that there's an issue so much as the way of examining the performance is underscoring something that is not an actual issue in real life.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I've heard it described to me is that, you know, talking to folks is that, you know, the probably the most representative battery life test for most people is Facebook. How long does your phone last when you're using Facebook?
Yeah, that's with the video playing and they did some janky stuff in the background too. So
But I mean, even ignoring that, that's the app that most people use.
Yeah.
And it's got video, it's got chat, it's got a whole bunch of
stuff in it.
Yeah.
And if you look at the this is the one thing that really annoyed me about this whole process was that people would say, well, Geekbench is they're doing this thing and they're CPU intensive, so I'm gonna load up this other app that's also CPU intensive, like encoding video on the iPhone. And pretty sure I left a dent in my desk from my head slamming against it. Sort of like, no, you're using a fixed path there. Like, video on an iPhone is cheap.
Yeah.
Unless you're using something like Skype, which has got its own custom codecs because of the whole cross-platform nature of Skype. If you're running Facebook on your iPhone, if you're running YouTube, if you're running any of these things, they're using the dedicated, H.264 hardware?
Yeah.
And that's super efficient and super low power and isn't affected by the issue. And it's like, you don't understand what's going on. And
doesn't, yeah.
But there's other, wasn't there also a time when different manufacturers would code towards benchmarks, which also made it hard to sort of figure out what was going on?
Wasn't there a
or
time?
Benchmarks in general? Well, I don't know if they still do it.
I was going to say there's a time, okay. And that time is now.
Oh, there's still, okay.
Time is always, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a,
stuff like OpenGL support and drivers is like, it certainly used to be like, well, what's Carmack doing? Okay, make that work.
Yep.
And if he's not using it, maybe it'll work. I don't know. Yep. We're not going to bother testing it, really. So
we've been doing for Geekbench 4, one of the things we've been doing is using OpenCL and Metal to do some performance analysis of GPUs just from sort of a compute perspective because, you know, especially in mobile, it's turning out that a lot of people are using OpenCL for not so much on iOS because OpenCL is not really allowed on there, but on the Android side of things, a lot of the Android camera apps are actually OpenCL powered. They're using it for, they're finding running on the GPU, even though that a lot of the mobile GPUs are sort of anemic and underpowered, they run faster and they're more power efficient than the CPU for certain image processing tasks. So we're throwing in some of those in the mix for Geekbench 4. But what we're finding is that when we're doing this GPGPU programming, if we do something even slightly off the beaten path, then the driver gets confused and falls down. Because that's it exactly. It's sort of a, what's the common path? How do people use this? Oh, you're not on that common path anymore? Well, hopefully it'll work. It may not be fast.
What I find also interesting is just talking to people, like, because not everyone follows this process stuff, but they get thrown numbers at them all the time. Like almost every show mm-hmm. has numbers involved and they'll say, well, this has 2 cores, but 8 core here, or is this 4 times this Cori? And it doesn't, like, it's hard to judge based on the different chipsets with the different cores, what that actually means to real world performance.
It's like the megahertz war from 10, 15 years ago.
I don't know if people know this or not, but Galaxy S7 has 2 different processors too. It has the, I know some people know this, but I don't know if the wide audience does. It has the Qualcomm, is it the 820?
Yeah.
And also,
and
Exynos.
The thing that I find is that, I mean, Samsung's dual sourced their CPUs like this for ages, and I'm not sure how much of this has got to do with yields. Versus how much of this has to do with like GSM
modem certification? Yeah,
yeah, exactly. But the thing is, the thing that I think people were frustrated with Apple just, you know, looking at the comments from it, was that with a Samsung phone, you know what you're getting. If you're savvy enough to know that there's a difference between the processors, you look at the model number and it's like, oh, I have a GM-900W8. Okay, that's a Qualcomm chip. Oh, this is the 925. It's an Exynos chip. They're fairly consistent, and you know, certain SKUs have certain chips. With Apple, it was random. I mean, I remember going to our Apple store in Yorkdale here in Toronto, and basically saying, I will take 3 iPhones, please. And they said, why do you need 3? And I'm like, I'm hoping to win the lottery, because we only had, 2 on site here, and they were both TSMC, and I was just trying to find a Samsung.
Yeah, I couldn't find a Samsung one either.
No, it took out of those 3 phones, we had 2 TSMC and 1 Samsung.
But at the same token, I mean, those A9s are still broadly similar chips. Like, they have the same image signal processor and all things, where Qualcomm's A20 and Exynos are fundamentally different chips.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And it's a much bigger difference. I know Ars Technica today just published their Galaxy S7 review, and they break it out by, here's how the A20 performs, here's how the Exynos performs. And while they're kind of similar-ish, I mean, the A20 is a quad-core chip. It's a two big, two little design.
Yeah.
Whereas the Exynos chip is a 8-core where it's 4 big, 4 little. And this, I mean, it's MediaTek has a 10-core chip coming out.
And the A20 is cooled, which, like, you would, if you told me there'd be a cooled chip in.
Well, they've been doing that since the Windows phones, the Lumias,
yeah,
out the end of last year. Those ones have cooling in them as well.
I want to call them water cooling, but it's not precisely that. It's some sort of.
It's a heat pipe of some,
yeah,
sort. Yeah.
Yeah, and evaporation cooling.
I mean, it's kind of like, I remember, like, you know, the going back to the Commodore 64 and the Atari ST, those were both passively cooled. Same thing with the 386. But
just the idea of a little water cooling thing in my phone is just, it seems both futuristic and horribly throwbackish at the same time.
Right. And but it's one of those, is that just where we're headed?
I think so. I mean, everyone's going to be hitting the same thermal and physical and economic conditions.
Mm-hmm. Like Apple somehow, and I don't know, I think they've basically just, you know, when they bought PA Semi, I think they came with a contingent of elves.
yeah.
Just because what they're doing with thermals, I don't understand it.
They've got that some amazing best, people there.
Yeah, that was one of the best purchases they ever made. And that was years ago.
Well, I remember people when the acquisition happened, everybody said, oh, they're bringing back PowerPC, because PA Semi was doing this dual core PowerPC chip.
Yeah.
And people This is going to be great. But what's interesting is, I didn't realize this at the time, is a lot of those people were through, before PA Semi, were at Digital, mm-hmm, working on the Alpha chip.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they've done some amazing stuff I remember the A6 was the first chip they did that was really impressive.
The story I heard at the time was that, just like Steve Jobs said, you know, I want really good sushi at Cafe Max. They went and, like, got really good sushi guys. Like, I don't know how to pick these chips. Get me somebody who's just really amazing at chips.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just started building resources out. And then some truly amazing people have been through the Apple. John Cerugi's technology, was it hardware platform engineering department?
Yeah. The A5 seemed like a standard ARM. Print,
yeah, like basically. The A4 and the A5 were nothing to write home about. They were sort of like, oh yeah, they were competently done chips and nothing special. And then the A6 came out.
Yeah.
And I remember that was basically, I don't think I slept for 2 or 3 days, because I was just, I was busy basically bailing out the lifeboat that was our server. Just trying to keep it up, disabling features, you know, we were just, because everybody was like, holy crap, this iPhone 5 is so fast and this is amazing. And I remember when the A7 came out, I was at Intel's conference, IDF, in San Francisco, and Intel was in the middle of their briefing about how they were going to do 64-bit mobile chips in 2014. Isn't this exciting? Yeah. And I saw the press people in the front row, like, get up and leave, and I thought, that's really weird. And I open up, and I'm like, I wonder what's going on at the Apple event. Apple announces 64-bit mobile chip. And it just caught everybody by surprise. And I thought, what the hell? Like, it's one of the few times that I can remember professionally that I've been speechless.
I expected another year or two at least before they got to.
Oh yeah. Like they announced the iPhone 5S the day the ARM V8 specification was formally ratified and available. Like, it was basically, I remember I went back to my hotel room and got, like, remember hopping on the group chat, and I'm like, okay, so we need to do a 64-bit port. like, we just launched Geekbench 3. And I thought, okay, this is great. You know, it's out. We've sort of, the dust has settled from the launch. We can take a break. I can go to a conference and not worry about stuff. I remember staying up till 2 or 3 in the morning in my hotel in San Francisco, frantically working with the other folks, trying to get a 64-bit version out in time for the time that the iPhone 5S shipped. Wow. You know, not even having hardware to test on, just going like, hope this works. It builds in the simulator. So
it's fine. Ship it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's just every once in a while, Apple pulls a rabbit out of their hat. And I'm like, how did you do that? Now, I mean, the A9 and the A9X are very impressive chips. What gets me, though, is the fact they don't throttle.
Yeah.
We can throw sort of one of our torture tests at it that we have internally. That most chips, if you put them on one of the other ARM chips that are, you know, passively cooled, they'll fall over. They'll run at, you know, for maybe if you're, you know, lucky, you'll get 5-10 minutes, and then they'll just start clocking down to, because they've run out of thermal headroom. But the 6S and the iPad Pro, not even the iPad Pro. I mean, the iPad Pro's got this massive case that can act as a huge heat sink and dissipate heat, and that's great. But even in the 6S, you run that at full tilt, and it just takes it and keeps on going. I do not understand it.
So this is, you know, obviously you can't answer this question, but where do you see things going? I mean, obviously faster is the answer, but more cores, like the way we used to think, or is it now, do you think we've tapped out in as far as our CPU capacity is good?
Will A10 be quantum is what Guy wants to know.
No. I mean, I just mean like, are we going to now focus on battery, or are we going to focus on performance or heat dissipation? Or like, do you have a sense of where things will go?
I don't. And it's kind of I think what's happened is the industry's basically, Apple gave the industry whiplash, I think, in some ways. Yeah. I don't think that's necessarily a controversial statement. Because when they came up with the 64-bit chip, I think basically that evening, every other major ARM vendor just took its roadmap, lit it on fire, and said, okay, we have to start over. I think that's one of the reasons why Qualcomm with the A10, they went away from their own custom cores to the A53 and the A57 ARM designs. Mm-hmm. And now with the 820, they're finally back on the Cryo core. I don't think more cores are necessarily the answer. It hurts me to say that. Because part of, you know, when I was at Rapidmine and when I was at Intel, one of the things we really wanted to do was make multi-core programming easier. But I think it's a fundamentally hard problem. I think, there are definitely places where more cores make sense. I think in the server world, you know, you can put a chip, you can put 32 cores on a chip. Great. You can, you know, a server servicing 32 different web tasks, there's very little coordination. You know, so long as you've got enough memory bandwidth, you're golden. But on mobile, like, you might have, you know, the web browser in the foreground, maybe you've got iTunes or what have you in the background playing music. You know, there's not a lot of parallelism there you can exploit. There are actually some interesting papers out of, oh crap, I'm completely blanking on the architecture group. One of the ACM subgroups, the Association of Computing Machinery. There were some interesting papers out of one of their conferences last year, basically saying that for mobile, 2 cores is the sweet spot. And for desktop, it's 4 cores. Just saying that after that, it's sort of diminishing returns because most applications can't take advantage of it. Google Chrome is one of the exceptions to this. Google Chrome does a lot of, like, spawns off multiple threads on, Android, because, you know, you'll have these Android chips where you've got 4, 8, 10 cores. You know, if you can use all 4, 8, 10 cores and get, like, this, you know, great user experience out of that, then why don't you?
They do threads, or their multi-process model?
They're threads. They're, I don't think they're doing a multi-process model. I think they're too tightly integrated for them to sort of. Yeah. I don't think you can even fork on Android.
Well, it's because it's Chrome, so I thought maybe they did magic. But
yeah, no. It's just, I think they're just using threads. Whereas I think with Apple, I think they're definitely, you know, Safari's multi-threaded, because there's definitely some huge wins to be had by just sort of kicking off your JavaScript compiler off into a separate thread. Oh, yeah. But I think Apple sort of takes the view, and it's the view that I subscribe to as well, that single core performance is really what matters for most people.
Is there anyone else? I mean, we talked about Apple before. We talked about Qualcomm. Is there anybody else who's doing interesting things? I think some of the NVIDIA stuff I've seen has been interesting NVIDIA, lately.
I'm trying to think of what I can say here. Again, this is another case of where I've said stuff about NVIDIA in the past, and the next thing you know, I'm in Motley Fool.
I just mean in general, they seem like one of the companies who are restless, that aren't doing, content with what is.
They had the X one. I want to say, which was basically, it felt like the new Transmeta, where the story I heard about this was they had this dual core part that went into the Nexus 9 that took in ARM instructions, translated them into some internal representation, and then that's what they actually operated on. That was very much like the code morphing technology that you found in Transmeta in their chips in the, what was it, the late 90s? And the interesting thing was, we had some Transmeta results in the Geekbench browser for version 2, and they were competitive with Atom, Intel's mobile chip that was like 4, 5, 6 years after the fact. You know, lower power, but roughly the same performance. I mean, they really were ahead of their time.
Yeah, Transmeta was very cool. Also, that idea got, it's basically what x86 assembly happens to do anyway.
Yeah,
it gets broken down into microcode internally, and
Another one of those things that makes me want a head desk, because whenever somebody says, oh well, you know, x86 is never going to be able to be low power because of the instruction set and blah 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 blah, and it's like, well, no one actually uses x86 aside from, you know, this really tiny bit of silicon that like translates it into opcodes and off it goes.
Man, your desk must be brutalized.
Yeah, this is why we buy the expensive Herman Miller desks here. It's sturdy. Otherwise, there'll be parts all over the floor. Anyway, also why we have emergency scotch in the office, but the less said about that, the better. So NVIDIA came out with a chip, the Tegra X1, that, you know, had like their desktop glass graphics in it, which are really speedy. And they had this dual core chip that was really fast. That was basically doing this code morphing thing that Transmeta did. They've not shared a lot of the details about that. But the general idea was that the story I've heard was NVIDIA really wanted to make an x86 chip. They wanted to go off and they wanted to make something they could compete with Intel with. And then they basically found out, well, there's no way in hell that Intel's going to license the instruction set to them. They're not going to get that critical x86 license. So they thought, well, screw it. Let's make an ARM chip. So they made an ARM chip. And I think it's only been in the Nexus 9. And the Nexus 9 had really wonky performance the first couple of months, just because this chip was so new and, you know, there's only so much simulation you can do inside of a company. You know, like someone like NVIDIA is not going to have necessarily the visibility into how people are using the tablets that, say, Apple has. I mean, this is one of the, ignore the fact that they've got, you know, magic elves working for the processor division. The fact that Apple is so tightly vertically integrated, they make the chip, they make the compiler that powers that builds the software that runs on that chip. They also distribute all the software that runs on that chip, as well as the operating system. I mean, there's just I've had a couple of discussions with Apple engineers at WWDC, and there's then the odd time they have an offhand comment, and they're like, oh yeah, you know, this is X percent of execution time across all applications. Apple has visibility into stuff like that other manufacturers don't. Like, Apple can be really smart and really strategic about where they spend time. Whereas other companies like NVIDIA, they're dealing with, like, you know, they make the chip and HTC makes the device and Google makes the operating system and the compilers, and there's not that same level of information sharing or information gathering that they can collect. And so they had to patch a lot of stuff after the fact.
Well, to your previous point, Qualcomm is making chips for Windows Phone and Android, and it's got to support everything that those phones do. So Apple doesn't have to carry anybody else's load.
Well, I mean, Intel, like, they make an architecture and it's got to run on how many different classes of devices? It's
got to work magical elves of their own.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's just Apple can cater their chip to what they need. And if it works in all their devices, great. And if it doesn't, then, well, they'll do something different. Like, it was when they do, say, you know, the A9 and the A9X, you know, oh, you know, we know we need this for that, so we'll do this. As opposed to if you're most device manufacturers, I mean, I think Samsung is really the only other company that has its own internal chip division like that. You know, Samsung can go to, you know, like the Samsung semiconductor team can talk with the Samsung mobile team and talk, you know, they can have some information sharing that way. But I think that's the only other place that does that, or that, sorry, has the possibility of doing that. I don't know how much they talk internally.
What do you think about foundries these days? Because for a while it was like, oh, if Apple could only get Intel to fab their chips. But now it seems like, you know, Taiwan Semiconductor, Samsung, everybody is doing a pretty good job at fabbing.
I think it's Intel had a huge fab lead that for whatever reason they've lost. And my hunch is that we're just getting to the point where it's, you know, Intel's TikTok model where they release a new process node every other generation of chips, where they go from, you know, 28 to 20 to 14. I'm getting the numbers wrong, but the rough idea is that the chips keep shrinking. I think that model's starting to fall apart. Like they're talking, you know, most of the...
Well, Kaby Lake is a talk now, isn't it? I think
it's going to be, you're going to have 2 on 14 nanometer before they go to 10. Most conferences I've been to where they talk about these things, they're talking quite seriously as a, what do we do when we hit 7? Because no one seems to have a really good idea what comes after 7. Because you're getting to points where it's not even necessarily the physics of it are insurmountable. It's just, it's going to be so bloody expensive. No one's going to want to do it.
You put guy in the Ant-Man suit, give him a blowtorch.
Exactly. It'll be great. But this is the real concern, is that, you know, it's expensive. It's hard, and the fact that Intel's still on 14 when, say, TSMC and Samsung have caught up to 14 as well, I think is quite telling. It's interesting, too, when you get into, like, the actual discussion of what 14 nanometer means, and people are starting
to... It's all marketing terms,
it's like, well, it's the lithography is this, but they're actually using a wavelength of that, and it's just sort of like, oh, my goodness. And you just sort of, like, again, desk on head, or head on desk, and... shake your head, move on.
I like the escalation of, you just pick up the desk and you hit it.
Exactly.
You hit yourself in the head with it.
It's no longer just, you know, I've got to bring the desk to me. Nothing else will do. but I mean, it's getting to the point where people are splitting hairs. Like, well, Intel's got a true 14 nanometer process and TSMC's is really a 2014 nanometer hybrid. And it's like, well, who cares? Like, you know, it's Intel's going to be stuck on 14 for a while. Like, the progress is slowing down. I don't think it hurts. Apple, of all the companies out there, I think Apple would definitely have the cash for it to go out and buy or build a foundry. The question is, would they want to?
Yeah, they're leasers, not owners.
Yeah, it's sort of, you know, like, oh, great, TSMC is doing it. I mean, it paid dividends for the, as much as Chipgate was kind of this weird little blip. You know, first iPhone launch where they weren't supply constrained.
Yeah, I think people don't realize too, like when you complain that you can't get a device at launch time, or you complain that this device has a new chip but that one doesn't, just how hard it is to put out stuff like A8s or Touch ID sensors or all that kind of stuff.
But they did it. They did it for the iPhone 6S, and it's the first time they've ever done that. And it was weird just being able to walk into an Apple store and say, I would like a new iPhone, and not think for the 2 months after a launch, if you don't get it at launch day, you're screwed.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, it's the sort of like what the future brings. I think more and more devices are focusing on single core. I think single core is where most of the importance is. If you look at Qualcomm, I mean, Qualcomm's walked back on core count. The 810 was a 4+4. The 820 is a 2+2. So they've gone from 8 to 4. I think there's definitely some interesting stuff. I think Apple could maybe go up to 4 cores and do some interesting things with them, but at the same time, I think dual core is suiting them just fine. You're not doing a lot of multitasking. If you look at, honestly, a lot of Apple's lineup right now, outside of the desktop and the 15-inch MacBook Pros, they're all dual cores.
Mm-hmm.
And they do just fine. So sort of what the future brings, I'd like to see what I'd really like to see is what Apple's team could do if they got onto the desktop. That would be, I'd be really interested to see an ARM powered Mac. Not that I say think necessarily this will happen, but it would be really interesting to see, like, because I think Intel's kind of ignored the desktop because they're busy fighting the mobile fight. And from what I've heard internally from folks that I still know at Intel, basically, like, Intel reorganized to become a mobile processor company, and desktop kind of is what it is. And they don't, unfortunately, AMD has not really been competitive for the last few generations. It'd be kind of neat to see someone light a fire under their butt.
That would be interesting.
So, but at the same time, you know, we talked a little bit about this, the vertical integration of Apple. Would that model still work going into the desktop, where it's a little bit woolier and it's a little bit, you know, people are going to be running weird apps that don't necessarily go through the App Store? Or, you know, can the A9 design or say the A10 design scale up to desktop level loads? Can you put, you know, could you do a Mac Pro based on an A9 with, you know, 8 cores? Would the design support that? I don't know. It'd be interesting.
I don't think you'd mess with the Mac Pro, probably not. But the MacBook, I could certainly see that being powered by an ARM.
Yeah, well, I think you could swap out the Core M and put in an A9X, and I think you'd be fine.
Surface Book, I'm just crying. Really,
yeah, I really think you would. But
yeah,
you know, because I mean, it's basically an iPad.
Yeah,
like I'm using one right now. It's light. It's small. It has properties that no other Mac has in terms of the way spin locks are handled. It's more akin to the way iOS does it. I don't know. It's a super interesting machine. And I think if you want to look where they want MacBooks to, or portables at least, to go, the MacBook is what you want to be looking at.
Things that make you say,
Well, despite all the weirdness of it. You know,
It feels like a Mac that was released 2 years too early.
Yes.
Yeah. Like the original Air.
I mean, the Air kind of made sense in the ecosystem that was around it. It's more the thing that I find frustrating with the MacBook. I mean, personal preference, I hate the keyboard. Something about the way they laid out the keys or something like that. Just something about the arrow keys drives me insane.
That's why.
Yeah, exactly. And I realize at some point in time, I'm going to have to get used to the wrongness, and that makes me sad. But for now, I'm you know, everything else uses the mushy old school keys with real amounts of travel. So I've stuck with those. But what I find about the MacBook frustrating is that you've got the one port.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not.
Yeah.
Like, right now, I have a dongle to add a couple of ports. Like for the power and for the USB for the mic.
Didn't Schiller say you were lucky to get one? Wireless. I think in the era of wireless, it's like, well, you've got to have one for power, so might as well make it a multi-purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I just find it an interesting machine. Like, I find the Mac Pro an interesting machine.
Yeah. Which,
and in both cases, I don't think they're for everybody, and they've got niche. You know, they attack different niches.
The thing that when the MacBook came out, I went with my wife and we looked at them in person, and I realized how compelling this machine was, because she looked at it and she's like, "Oh, I want this." Like, she doesn't care it's got one port. She doesn't care that it's, you know, passively cooled. She doesn't care about any of this stuff. It's thin, it's light, and it's sturdy. Like, that is not I don't know. There are other thin laptops out there. I mean, we see a lot of them just because we test on everything here. But I pick one of them up by the corner and wiggle, and the whole machine feels like it's about to fall apart. The MacBook is solid. It is such a beautifully engineered machine. The downside is that for, you know, power users, quote unquote, it's a lot of compromises. But I mean, I took my MacBook this year to WWDC, and it suited me just fine. For a travel machine where I'm not doing a lot of heavy lifting, perfect.
Yeah, right. Yeah, don't get me wrong. I'm not advocating that this should be. If you're going to get one Mac, get the MacBook. Don't do that. And in fact, when I travel, I actually, this is stupid, I travel with my, like, a 2011 Air and my MacBook. it's dumb. There's like software testing reasons. It makes a bit of sense. But I do actually keep another machine around that's not the MacBook. I find the MacBook to be like a, it's like a super iPad in a way. Mm-hmm. It's like an iPad that happens to run OS X.
There's a lot to, and I'm not even sure what Apple could do necessarily to, because I mean, I've looked at this and I've sort of gone, it feels like it's a, you know, sort of an iPad that runs OS X. I mean, it really, if you swapped out the guts for an iPad and like you just had the real hardware keyboard, I think you'd be hard pressed to notice the difference in weight or performance.
Yeah.
But
so that's where I'm going with the ARM stuff. Like,
yeah, it's just, it's, there's part of me too, though. It's like, you know, performance for most things isn't that different than, say, a 2011 MacBook Air. But there's just something about the MacBook Air, the fact that it's got the old school USB ports, the fact that it has more than one port, that sort of stuff, that it feels a little more like a computer.
Yeah.
And these are completely insane reasons to say, well, you know, it's, you know, real computer as opposed to like iPad, which is just for consumption.
yeah.
But I mean, you know, like someone like my wife, who's not, you know, she's no dummy, but she's not, you know, an uber nerd either, looks at the MacBook and goes, this is a really nice machine. I really like the look of it. I would like one of these.
I just like it because OS X is such muscle, like everything from multi-window to drag and drop to all these different workflows is just muscle memory for me now. So it's, there's just so many workflows I can do so quickly without even thinking about it.
Well, it is. I remember switching when I switched in 2002 to the Mac. I spent that first weekend going, what the heck was wrong with me? Why did I do this? Because my muscle memory from Windows was just saying, no, wrong. I want to do this. I don't know how to do it. Oh, this sucks. And it's just, it's the, all these tiny little frustrations add up and you just want to throw the thing out the window. Now I go back to Windows and I'm like, this is dumb.
Yeah.
Then it's just, you know, you're used to one way of working.
Well, the human brain is also built that way. Like you go from a smaller to a bigger phone and then the small phone, like the big phone looks ridiculous. And then a couple hours later, the small phone looks ridiculous. Then you switch back and the big phone, like, we're very good at resetting what we think is normal.
Oh, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, small phone to big phone is a perfect example of that. I thought the 6 was ridiculous. And then I went back to the 5S a week later and I thought, how did I ever do anything on this phone?
Exactly. I still want a smaller phone.
Well, wait a week.
Yeah, wait a week. It's a hack to have to do the, what do they call it? The reveal gesture when you double tap on the...
See, I'm so used to the 6 Plus now. I never use that. I just flip it around in my hand and I go to the top corner, then I flip it back to the bottom and it becomes like your bullseye after a while, guy.
Yeah, that's dumb.
It sounds like you're using your phone like a switchblade. You're throwing it around in your hand and you're doing this weird thing to distract somebody while you mug them. I don't know.
Well, I do everything on my iPhone because I'm out and about and I need to run iMore and I can do it from an iPhone and it's nice and big and I can see all these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not saying that's a silly form factor. I just find that like it's cumbersome. Mm-hmm. There's got to be a better way to do this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like there's
Tony Stark projector phones.
Sure. Yeah.
Google Glass.
Google, yeah. and with that, let's call it a show.
No, there's a lot to like about the I like the 6. I think actually the 6 is not a bad size for what I do with it, which is honestly a lot of it is, you know, using it as a camera these days. So, you know, I've got a 15-month-old. And, you know, grandparents who live far away and, you know, friends who are like, oh, what's the munchkin up to today? And so, you know, and it's nice to have a big screen for a viewfinder. And, you know, most of my email, I use this very much as a read-only device. I hate typing on the soft keyboard. I just, it drives me nuts. I've used a BlackBerry before and I really like the hardware keyboard. Software keyboard just drives me nuts. So I tend to use it as a read-only device, and the bigger screen for that is just A-okay.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's just a weird compromise.
Oh, absolutely.
And maybe it's just because, I don't know, I can't reach the top corner, top right corner, and the done button is there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it just seems weird. Yeah. Basically, if the OS had been designed with this size screen, I think different choices would have been made.
Well, we can wait for the big redesign that will be iOS 10.
You remember when Nitin was on, he was saying that the original iPhone was the biggest phone they could make at the time. There's just no way to make that phone bigger.
Yeah, which makes sense. Yeah. iOS X.
Still pronounced 10. It's not like the X-Men.
Cool, man. Thank you so much for your time. Is there anything you want to like promote?
Buy Geekbench. Lots of copies. One for everybody you know.
Gift it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's a great stocking stuffer for the holidays when they come up in 9 months. No, that's about it. I mean, our big exciting thing is I've kind of hinted at is Geekbench 4. That's coming out someday.
Wait, not Geekbench 3S? This is going to be a full-on Geekbench 4.
This will be a full-on Geekbench 4, you know, with upgrade pricing and everything. You know, we're actually going to charge real money for it.
Nice.
No, that's coming out probably in May, which will be exciting. You know, new benchmarks. We're doing all sorts of cool stuff, you know, better than 3. Not that 3 is bad and you shouldn't go out and buy it today, but 4 will be even better. But other than that, no, not really. It was nice to chat about this stuff. It's always fun to sort of look back and be like, how did I end up here? What am I doing?
Who are you people? And why are you in my room?
Exactly. Why did I suddenly stumble on this podcast just when you happen to be talking about Geekbench? It's such a strange coincidence.
Yeah, it's just the way the universe works.
Exactly. No, this was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Cool. Yeah, it's been a blast, man. Are you on Twitter? Do you want anybody to listen to you on Twitter? Or are you scared?
I say crazy things on Twitter. And
yeah, me too.
Yeah, it's sort of like, hey, new Mac Pros. And then the next thing you know, it's, you know, a rumor. JF Pool on Twitter. You can follow the corporate account too and, you know, be apprised of all the latest and the greatest happenings. We do Geekbench at Geekbench and at Primate Labs. Pro tip is when you ever start a company and you think, haha, this will never amount to anything, still pick a somewhat serious name. Primate Labs was kind of a bit of a, hey, Code Monkeys, this is a fun joke. And the number of times I've had to explain, no, we actually aren't doing medical research here.
We are not experimenting on chips, apes, and orangutan.
Exactly. Although our
chips, not chimps.
I'm writing that down.
You can have that.
And we will use that. It's funny because we have, as our HR representative here on site, a stuffed baboon with a bright red ass. It's great. He's one of the many primates that works here.
Nice.
Yeah. No That's comment. The HR guy. He should probably warn you not to talk about his ass.
I'm sorry, but I mean, I will have to post something on Twitter about this, but it is, if you had an ass that red and that magnificent, you'd want to talk about it.
Fair enough. Yes. John, thanks so much. It's been really fun chatting and, hopefully I'll see you at WWDC at least, I think.
Presuming yeah. WWDC, are you guys attending NS North this year?
I don't think so.
I think I'm traveling.
Oh, okay.
I would like to, but yeah, I think I'm traveling too. So
cool. Well, I'll see you guys at WWDC.
Maybe they'll do one in Montreal at some point because God knows no one else is right now.
I know. It's just it's Montreal's the place to have conferences. There's that one.
Got
I
got the best bagels.
Doubleton?
Doubleton, yeah.
Singular. I'm gonna fixate on the bagel comment now and just say that you're wrong.
Okay. We've gone 2 hours. We can't open up this 8-hour argument.
Exactly. We'll all agree that the Montreal bagel, while a fine bagel, is no match for a Toronto bagel. And we'll just leave it at that.
So nobody ever. Toronto bagel? Okay, I gotta let it go.
We'll talk about this at WWDC.
Yes, after. Sir.
We'll have a knife fight about this.
It's going to get ugly.
Toronto bagels like Cleveland pizza.
I used to maybe think that, not being from Toronto myself, my wife would rave about them. But then you live on the West Coast and you're just like, I just want something.
Oh, yeah. Anything after the West Coast is great.
Okay.
Oh,
yeah. Well, yeah. So we can. I like that we can all agree to hate something. Yes. So it's like, oh, perfect.
Mutual enemy.
Exactly. Portland bagels. There we go.
The worst.
God, yeah, those are terrible.
Don't even get me started about the smoked meat out there. Anyway.
Okay. Yeah. I got to go because you're making me hungry and angry.
Okay. Angry.
Angry.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, John.
Thanks for having me. This was a blast.
Awesome.